Before I, Barry's got a very impressive background, but the most impressive thing, he played saxophone for a Grateful Dead tribute band, right? So, I'm impressed.
Actually, the most impressive part about it is my son's band.
He let you in?
Is that your son the doctor?
My son the doctor and lawyer.
Wow.
And
band leader.
Very impressive. Barry is president and CEO of MKA Executive and Professional Benefits in Woburn. For more than 40 years, MKA has served public and private health businesses in around the United States with customized supplemental non-qualified retirement and deferred compensation and retirement cash flow planning. In plain English, what that means is they want to hook the CEO to stay longer or the physicians to stay longer. They got some added benefits on the retirement side. Am I missing anything?
That's pretty good.
Okay.
I'll give you the $20 later.
The other thing about Barry, which makes him really very, very special, is that he is the living embodiment of every entrepreneur's wet dream. He built a business.
I'll get him to explain that later.
No.
He's going to explain it now.
I'm explaining it now. He built a business, sold the business, somebody else acquired the business, destroyed the business, and then Barry bought it back and is now rebuilding the business, which is, it's exactly the Steve Jobs issue. And, I can't tell you how many entrepreneurs, they sell their businesses, they regret they sell their businesses, they see their businesses going down the tubes, and they say, I'd love to come back, but they can't. It just never happened, but it happened for Steve Jobs, it happened for Barry. So that's what I mean by the entrepreneur's wet dream. But in the course of his work and Dennis's work, they deal with compensation committees of boards of directors. So when I think about MKA, I think of an organization that does a lot of work with banks around the country and hospitals and increasingly physician practice groups. Barry himself, as a board member, has served on the board of the New England Sinai Hospital for 20 years. He served as board chair of the organization since 2012 until its sale to Steward Healthcare.
Still are?
Okay. He also has served as chair of the Special Olympics Massachusetts Board. He's a graduate of Northeastern University and Boston School of Law. So Barry has a case for us. Barry?
Thank you, Larry. I appreciate all the kind words. As I said, I'll give you the payment later, except for one of them, how it was phrased. In any event, the case tonight talks about a not-for-profit organization that has some issues. And over the years, not only in my own experience as a board member on not-for-profit boards, but dealing with not-for-profit boards, I've seen a whole range of boards, from those who really just sit there and nod and then they take a vote, to those who challenge everything, and sometimes it seems like they're just a challenge because they didn't like somebody who's in management. Marianne's smiling, so she's been to both of those. And there's something about the general characteristic of not-for-profit boards that makes them somehow different from for-profit boards, particularly if they're getting a fee. I'm not sure what the impact of getting a fee and not getting a fee is, but I've often thought about taking some time to figure out how to study that, because I think it is a difference. And there's kind of a workshop that you can do. In Massachusetts, credit union directors do not get fees. They can't get fees. In Rhode Island, they can. And when you go to board meetings at institutions in either state, it's a different meeting. It really is. And it's hard to put your foot on it, but I think it's those who get paid have some more ownership than in the charitable arena particularly. In the healthcare arena, it's different because they've got specific goals and objectives and really have a full spread of management. But in the smaller not-for-profit human services agencies and so on, it varies widely from being board-run to being management-run, and sometimes just one manager-run. And I've tried to incorporate many of those issues into our discussion tonight. You go through it, and if you have more questions and want to learn more about it, I did some research, and the best document I could come up with was prepared by the Canadian Chartered Public Accountants. Sorry about that. And it's called 20 Questions Directors of Not-for-Profit Organizations Should Ask About Fiduciary Duty. And you can go online. I've got one copy here if you want to take the name of it down, or the first one to grab it and run with it and do that as well. But there was no cost to download it, and it's pretty thorough. It's accurate, and there's not significant difference between the pertinent law that they're quoting and what we see here in the United States. So it's a very informative book for those of you who are on boards and may want to distribute them to board members as well. Our case tonight is not unusual. It's a not-for-profit human services agency. It's been around for a long, long time, well back into the last century. And its main role in life is to bring in immigrants from a particular country, not on this continent, and bring them in, settle them, and help them get going in the U.S. and take care of them. It's been very paternal and maternal, to say the least. And over the past 10 years, you know, fundraising has been dwindling, contributions have been dwindling, as has the number of immigrants. So their main purpose is starting to shrink. Their biggest activity right now is that they own a bunch of apartment buildings that these immigrants have lived in, some for more than one or two generations, where it's really become housing, and it's a small island of these folks. The annual revenues are down to $4 million, and the expenses are another 25% of that. So they're running at a loss typically over the last several years, and their board-directed fund accounts are slowly being absorbed into those expenses. As we said here, the board has 25 members. I thought we'd make at least that tonight, but we're a little short, so maybe we can have better conversation, actually. And 15 of those have been there for more than 20 years. And I'm a candidate for that on the hospital board. I got off of Special Olympics at 16 years saying it's time for a change. But the change occurred to the hospital rather than the other way around, so I agreed to stay through the change, and we're coming to the end of that useful life, I think. So 15 of the board members have been there for more than 20 years. My favorite board member on the hospital board I'm on has been there 50 years. He's 94 years old, and I'd like to think he's the second sharpest person on the board. He argues that with me, and he usually wins. But what we have here is more close to the executive committee, and the executive committee has taken a bigger role in recent years because they're trying to figure out what's going on, and when the full board gets together, it's just too many people. And they're ending up having more of a social session than they are. They have drinks and dinner and whatever, and then getting business done. Each of you independently are sitting on the executive committee, the finance committee, and the governance committee. And each of you consider that your younger brother is the president and CEO at age 70 and has decided he's just not going to retire. Some of the board members, and maybe just as importantly, and this is what you see, some members of the served community are raising questions and want to know what's going to happen. They're concerned about the thing just fading into oblivion with no direction, no result, no decision, and so on. So now we're at a special executive meeting. We have 40 minutes for this meeting. And to start, I'd like to know if you have any other questions about the organization.
What's the value of the apartment buildings?
Probably about $8 million.
Is it in Massachusetts, and is it a 180 corporation in the state?
No, it's in New Hampshire.
Oh, it's in New Hampshire. Okay, you're lucky there. Yeah, okay. Yeah. No Attorney General's office involved?
I did plan that one intentionally. Okay, there's a follow-up question that you should be asking.
Is there a mortgage on the apartment buildings?
Uh-huh, about 50%.
I'm sorry, what was that?
A mortgage, 50%. So you've got $4 million equity as opposed to $8.
Oh.
And they're paying off $4 million of mortgage.
Right, yes, so they have monthly payments to amortize the $4 million.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got significant time to do that, but it's still eating up a lot of the cash flow. Any other questions you'd like to know about the organization?
Are there any other, about the organization?
Are there
any other organizations in New Hampshire that provide services to immigrant communities coming into the state?
There are, but not to this community.
Okay.
How long has the President CEO been in that role?
25 years. And by the way, if you look around Massachusetts, that's not unusual in social service agencies in Massachusetts to have a CEO. In fact, that's going to be a problem in Massachusetts within a decade.
Is there a similarly long?
No, Barry. It's an opportunity for a search firm.
Touche. It's going to be an opportunity for a search firm during the next 10 years. In fact, the Globe had a big article on it about 3 weeks ago.
Is that right?
About 4 weeks ago, about the coming shortage of executives for the human service agencies, because Massachusetts has tended to been way behind in compensation, and they're not going to be able to hire new people for what they're paying the current people. And many of the current people won't take raises because it's not that other people don't believe in the mission, but they think they are part of the mission as opposed to managing the mission, which I think people running organizations need to figure out.
Is there any rent or Section 8 allowance for the tenants, or are they there for free?
They're there for what they can pay. Many are not paying any, some are paying a little bit, but it's nowhere near enough for carrying costs. It may cover the maintenance costs.
Okay.
Are the apartments full? The units full?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Barry, the case says board designated funds are covering the operating shortfall. Is that capital from the investment fund? What are board designated funds?
All the other assets besides that current year's operating cash. Some people refer to it as endowment. In Massachusetts, endowment has a very technical definition. So I don't use the word endowment unless it's a true endowment. In Massachusetts, if you have an endowment, technically you can only use the earnings from the endowment in the mission of the organization. That's why everybody has what they call board designated funds.
So, do you have an investment committee on the board?
No.
So basically, within a decade, this operation, if it continues the same way, goes out of business.
That's what it looks like.
You have $5 million left. You're running a deficit of $1 million a year, and maybe you've got $4 million more in equity in your houses. So, somewhere within a decade, you're no longer operational.
That's what it looks like, unless this group comes together and figures out some strategies and actions that can be taken.
What are the current and or previous sources of fundraising success, such as
they've had dinners and events like that, golf tournaments once in a while, the typical human service agency kind of fundraising.
Has there been, may I ask, has there been any coverage, media, or publicity of any kind about this situation, about this organization?
No.
Are there any leaders within that community that you serve who might be interested in getting involved, or are they involved?
There are some leaders obviously involved on the board, others who have been there long enough not to be leaders anymore but to enjoy dinner and cocktails and whatever.
But would they be really, could they be helpful in terms of keeping this thing alive? I mean, if they...
That's one of the questions we've got to determine as a board. What can we do? So hold that, but I think that's absolutely true. I think one of the first thing that cries out is new blood. And that's absolutely right. But if you're a board member, does anybody know the three major obligations of a fiduciary? Because as a board member, whether you're a director or a trustee, whatever your label is, you're a fiduciary.
Duty of care.
Duty of care.
Loyalty and duty of mission. Nonprofit.
Okay. It's loyalty, care, and technically it's obedience, but that's the mission. But those are the three words. And so the duty of loyalty deals with things like conflict of interest. And what might be some of the conflicts of interest that pop up in a not-for-profit board situation?
I would think in this case, some of the 25 board members might be involved in organizations that maintain the apartment buildings.
That's likely on a board like this. Absolutely. So are you doing business with the organization? I think that's the first question.
And the board member who's the sister of the president conflict because he's earning money from the organization.
Yep. Okay, we have a relative who's the CEO.
Also, to Marianne's question, is there any relationship between who manages and how the investment fund is managed and members of the board who presumably would be separate from those roles?
No, it's being managed by one of the Fidelity or something like that. So that doesn't exist. But what about doing business with the organization? Is that okay?
It has to be disclosed.
Several rules that need to be, you need to disclose it, including the
amounts of
materiality. You need to, in my view, you need to have a competing quote. And you should also have in your bylaws an exculpatory clause that permits it. It should not be, along with setting out the standards for allowing that to happen. I don't want any conflict person, so I prefer not to have anybody on the board doing business, but that as a practical matter, that becomes very difficult. So you need some standards for that. And the best place to put them is in the bylaws so that it's binding on everyone. This is required by many organizations now. I think, frankly, the feds require it for anybody doing business with the government, and you're seeing it more and more. But each board member should be filing a disclosure each year with the organization as to any conflicts of interest they have, which would mean any business they're doing directly or any business that essentially a blood relative or a close blood relative is doing with the organization as well.
May I ask you, but it's not that uncommon for board members to be doing business with the organization?
It's not uncommon. The place you see it a lot is I almost cringe when I think about it, is the institution or organization's attorney quite often sits on the board, never mind has a relative.
Yeah.
And you know, that's, to me, that person needs, and I used to have some issues with that myself and disclose those issues, should not be voting on anything. But
Larry, when people have conflicts and they disclose them, does the board vote on whatever it is they're putting forward as to
it depends on what the bylaw says.
Okay.
I've seen them go both ways. If you really want to have good governance, I think the board should vote on it, but that's not required. Okay. The duty of care is kind of, to quote a certain football coach, do your job. I took a quote out of article that I read a while back, because I loved it. It says, it's stated as, show up, suit up, speak up, or get out. You know, be a board member, is really what it's saying. The level of care that you need to exercise can vary. Generally, it's what an ordinary person would exercise in terms of due diligence and making decisions. But if you are an attorney, or an accountant, or an investment advisor, and you're making any decisions or taking part in any discussions on those issues or matters that would be within your field of expertise, you then need to be held to the standard of an expert. And I think a lot of folks don't realize that. There's some important decisions about joining a board, whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit. In for-profit, we'll tend to do more work with people like Larry than not-for-profit, who will tend to do work with somebody's brother-in-law in terms of, well, what's your brother doing? You know, would you like to be on the board? Sure, why not? Never knew what skill was coming or anything like that. So I think that's got to change. Business is getting tougher for not-for-profits. Boards need to understand their responsibility, and it's no longer, wow, it's great to be on the Special Olympics board. It's, wow, it's great to be on the Special Olympic board, and what are we doing about protecting our athletes from strangers coming in to games? What are we doing to protect our athletes' health? What are we doing to guard the money and to interview coaches who deal with these athletes on a daily basis, and so on. So the world has changed as it's become more litigious. Everybody's become more aware, and as people have become more vocal, that may even be a more challenging place that you have to watch out for what you're doing. And the final one, obedience, is, as you said, mission. Are you doing for the organization actions that go with the mission of the institution? To whom or to what do those obligations apply? Let's take this example. Let's push it ahead 6 years and say nothing's happened. Now we've got an executive office with people in it. We've got people in the apartment buildings who are superintendents and janitors and carpenters and snow plowers and whatever else we have in terms of staff. And we need to make some decisions. Do we close down a building? Do we lay off people? And what do we owe the employees versus what do we owe our constituents who might be in that building that's closing down? And that's where the duties of all three come in. Are you acting purely in the interest of the organization? Is that the same as acting in the interest of the people who live in those apartments? That's an interesting question to debate.
What kind of relationship has this organization had with the town and where the buildings are located and their human services department?
It's been fine. It's not a welfare type situation, so they're not really relying on the town for services, but the town and there've been no problems, no issues, and so things have been good there. So if you're thinking that they might get some aid from the town, we'll come back to where they can, how they rescue.
I was more thinking that if we were down the road and we didn't, and we could see the end here, what the town could do to help with people who might be displaced and some kind of relationship have they had. That was sort of where I was.
Actually, that's a good thought. How about doing it a little differently and going to the town maybe and saying, you know, if we close this down, it's going to be more expensive for you than if you help us keep it open. So that might be one tactic to look at in the strategy of keeping it all together.
Barry, this is simultaneously a very specific question about this case.
Yeah.
It's also a more generic issue. In an organization like this, what is the role of the board in setting a strategy? In other words, creating the strategy versus reviewing and approving the strategy that's submitted to the board by the CEO. In other words, the governance literature says you can't expect a board to figure out the strategy because they're not there enough. They're only there for quarterly meetings. It's the CEO, this 70-year-old guy. He's the one who's to present to the board, this is my assessment, this is what I think we should do, this is what I think we should go, discuss it and vote it up or vote it down. But shouldn't be the board's role.
To actually come up with a strategy?
Yeah.
I agree. But what the board needs to do is watch, for want of a better word, the methodology of developing that strategy. And so the board can say to the CEO, come up with a strategy internally, but we also want you to get a consultant that has some expertise in this area to develop one for presentation as well. We'll decide which one we want, but we've been self-centered for all these many years. And circumstances are causing a change. No one's done anything wrong particularly, but we may need something more creative than or different from that which we would tend to do internally.
So in other words, Barry, you have a situation where you've got bloated expenses and decreased revenues, and nobody seems to be in a panic over it. So what you need to do is either get a new CEO in, which you can't do, I assume, in this situation, or you force an outside consultant to come in and do a strategic review and give you some options, and so that you wind up at the same result of getting a new CEO in the business.
Exactly.
Why is it that the CEO cannot be removed?
Because he's 70 years old, he's been there for 25 years, and all his friends are on the board.
I see. It would be kind of
not going to happen. Yeah. And that's,
you have
that's,
obviously not been on a nonprofit board.
And I can tell you, it is extremely difficult to get a board like that and then bring up the issue of term limits. Nobody raised that yet, but that was implied over here. And I've seen twice it be determined that there should be term limits. It's called death. And so that's you just can't do it. It's not going to happen. So you need to be able to get whoever. It should be the chair who has the conversation, but it may not be the chair, depending on the relationship. Someone's got to go sit with the CEO and say, we need to hire some outside help here, or none of us are going to be coming to dinners anymore.
I sit on a nonprofit board right now that a variation on this is occurring, and that the person who is the head of the organization, two people who are heads of the principals of the organization, are stepping down of their own, and founders of the organization as well, are stepping down from those roles. They want to step down for a bunch of reasons, and yet they, it's very much a working board, to your point. I mean, so many of us are very much engaged in this process, along with everything else, running the organization. step down. They say they want to step down, and yet the reality of perhaps due to variation on this theme, they cannot let go. And we are in the midst of a slow motion process of trying to.
That was
with all the diplomacy and everything involved.
The number of, and again coming back to Massachusetts, the number of CEOs of significant not-for-profit agencies in Massachusetts in the human services area, let's say with revenues of 50 million and up, who are in their mid to late 70s and show no signs of retiring, is absolutely amazing. If you look at the roster of the Provider Council, which is the Human Services Trade Association, you can almost pick them out. Mike.
Barry, you raised the issue of whether the board should be addressing the issue of setting strategy, and Larry questioned whether it was appropriate for the board or the permanent CEO. What's striking me is that maybe the whole issue of setting strategy is to develop a strategy for perhaps the wrong problem, a problem that over the 75 years or whatever has changed substantially enough that maybe what the board should be focused on is kind of redefining the problem, so to speak, and then have a discussion with the executive and the leadership of the organization about strategy. But maybe it is not inappropriate for the board to clarify and redefine the mission, set those parameters in a more concrete way, and maybe that will also reveal some of the very interesting facts that are presented in the background description, you know, like the three generations of beneficiaries living in the buildings, and you know the negative cash flow, et cetera.
I think you're right, but that's kind of what an outside consultant would do. I think you're saying the same, pretty much the same thing. You would expect one of the potential results from that, and I've gone through experience a few times in different organizations. One of the results of that is a review of should you change your mission. I mean, you know, making buggy whips wasn't good in the private sector after a while either. So I think that would easily could easily apply here if they put their mind to it.
And as you were inferring about getting local government involved, the whole environment and political landscape has changed dramatically over 75 years. So there may be a lot of options that were just never contemplated in the initial formation of the mission for the organization.
Well, I think that's true. And you see that in numbers of organizations that have these aha moments every once in a while. And I think that, again, either the CEO, if it's a CEO who isn't going forward by looking in the rearview mirror of his car, or the board should insist on a consultant that looks at a whole, not just how do we make these buildings last or how can we raise more money, but what should we be doing, maybe even including planning a wind down. I think not enough organizations do that, and they end up all of a sudden disappearing and leaving a lot of things hanging. And there's nothing wrong with having go out with I guess you call it hospice for organizations kind of activity.
The discussion so far in our session really sounds as if we're presuming that we have a closed universe here, that our current clients and the buildings that we have, almost have a fence around them. That's it. And we have some people throwing money in every now and then. It's not enough. But given the longevity of our organization, you would think that there would be a diaspora of people that have been helped who are not living in our buildings anymore. Assuming people have been coming for 75 years, and we don't have that many buildings, and they must have be somewhere. Yep. And you also have the religious aspect to it, whichever religion it tends to be, probably one, if they're all from the same place. And there are public assistance aspects to the greater congregations of participants in those religious organizations that also have a common interest with trying to preserve the well-being of the entire community, not just the people in our buildings. Now that has to either have become more important or less important over the 75 years. But it seems that we as a board need to consider the entire universe, including all of those other, what I will call stakeholders, and even including public officials, because they have issues to deal with if we can't deal with our issue. And even to the extent of saying maybe the time has come for our organization to wind down because of the diaspora, because of other things. Well, the only issue may be what's the best way to transfer ownership of our buildings to the people that are living in them.
That might well be, and that's
if people aren't coming in, and we don't, you know, we've done our job. Yeah. You know,
and that's the kind of analysis you'd expect from a consultant. Where can we get more revenue to stop the drain? What can we do with our assets? Do we have a viable future? And those would be the questions, and they're hard to ask of a CEO, never mind this particular one who's been there forever and thinks that's going to continue, but to anyone who's been there and given any part of themselves to that organization for even 5 years, that's hard to ask. That's why you want to go out and find a consultant, and there are many out there who do that kind of analysis. Plus, it helps the board to make a decision on factors and facts it did not develop. So it ends up not being self-serving or selfish or folly, even.
I worry about the assets and the money, and then if the organization changes, is that okay to move to a new organization, or do you have to return it to people who've given it, or?
That's interesting what you do. If you shut down and not merge with another not-for-profit, if we use Massachusetts law, I've been in charge of a process like that. I was 6'6" when I started. In fact, I am finishing that process this month. It started in June of 2012.
Let's say my father set up a trust for this organization. For the benefit of children in this who are from this ethnic group, and now you don't have any immigrants coming in, you don't have any children. Mm-hmm. So what do you do with the trust money? What do you do with the trust fund? Okay. I mean, that was set up a very specific, targeted for a very specific population. Times have now changed. And now it's no longer appropriate. What do you do?
In Massachusetts and Texas, the two states I really know this particular aspect of the law pretty well, because I've lived it, there's a process. And you just can't decide to give it to another charity that you like or seems good. You need to find a charity or charities, not-for-profits, that are as close to your mission as you can define, convince the Attorney General that mission is a correct one and can be accepted. In Massachusetts, you actually then sue the Attorney General to be allowed to do that, and the institutions you're going to distribute these funds to have to join in the lawsuit against the Attorney General. If you've done it right, the Attorney General's already agreed to lose. But try to explain to other charities why you're suing the Attorney General. And then you go to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts with that lawsuit. And hopefully they sign off.
Is this for a private trust?
This was a charitable trust, so the charity was the trustee of it, I assume.
Okay, once it's there.
If it's a private trust, it might depend. If it was irrevocable and there's no flexibility for, you know, it means it was poorly drawn, there's no flexibility, no vision that this organization would somehow disappear, so there's no remainder repository organization or whatever, yeah, you're going to be in that same boat.
The question Mr. King did down there is in the crisis management area. At what point do you bring in somebody with his expertise into the picture?
Probably, depending on the organization, but if you know Harry, then you might bring him in just before the vote.
Well, crisis, but, you know, it's a lousy word for it.
It's a nasty news situation.
Nasty news, absolutely. Yeah. And the unlikely event of a water landing kind of thing. I mean, I don't know, but it's really the communication function and this internal communication function.
Yeah, it's internal and external. Because guess when the folks in the diaspora are going to weigh in?
Well, that's
as soon as you make the announcement.
Yeah. I asked early on if there was any you know, in the outside world, the media, whatever you want to call it, the outside world, was there any social media, was there anything going on about this thing amongst the answer, if I'm correct, was no. But as this thing gets a little more traction,
Absolutely. There will be hell to pay somewhere along the line when you look at this, guaranteed.
Well, the answer to your question, it's good to have somebody available on an advisory basis and so forth and so on.
Yeah, that's a good practice.
Right, but the issue is how in the world are you going to pull this off to get agreement, to get a consultant in, to review everything? That's a real challenge. If everybody is comfortable in their positions, then somehow you've got to move enough people to agree to do this.
Well, that takes, on every board, there's a key group, a handful. I don't care how big your board is or how small, there's a nucleus of people who don't have any relatives. I've been on two boards where I was asked because I didn't know anybody.
And so if they don't face it, they haven't been carrying out their duty of care.
Yeah, I mean that you need someone who's going to raise their legal fiduciary duties and face it. I mean, because the way you do it is you say, well, we have to do something. This is not good exercise of our obligation as a board. So we need to do something. The next best thing we can do beyond ignore it or close it down is to do what we should do as thinking people and figure out what we ought to think about. We're not experts in that. So let's go hire XYZ consulting firm or bring in two or three consulting firms to talk to us, and then agree to hire one of them to go out and bring back this analysis of what potential we have for survival, what we may need to change, or whether we need to say, you know, we're coming up on almost a century of great work. Let's have a party and let the world know that. Do we have a vote?
A set of thoughts sort of spurred by the comms issue and, you know, thinking about it as a crisis versus not a crisis. I suppose this would all be just either part of the assignment for the consultants or you know, come out of that in some way. But depending upon the circumstances of how things have changed and why, I mean, let's assume for a second that this nonprofit actually hasn't been poorly managed. And it's mostly external circumstances, maybe beyond their control. There's certainly nonprofits around that struggle from a lack of federal funding that used to be there, but
similar
constituent beliefs about level of services and so on. And, you know, these are much larger forces. I mean, maybe there's, again, I suppose the consultant might come back with some view on this, but maybe there's a way of actually raising a public issue to say, look, you know, the environment that used to provide into what this organization can do has vanished, and that's created a hole in sort of the public sphere. And maybe there's some way of actually using press to the advantage of solving this problem rather than, you know, becoming a crisis of bad management or something.
Well, I think that's part of the whole thing, and a good consultant should say, well, you know, we know there's this organization down the street. They take people from the other side of the country, and maybe you combine forces and have one staff. Or those are the kinds of things that should come back. It's not going to be you need to go out and figure out how to raise another $1 million a year, which may be one of the solutions, but they may not have the capacity for that, nor is it likely to be you got to shut this thing down. So it goes on and on.
Barry, can I ask a question about the issue about duty of obedience? Mm-hmm. So you got obedience to the mission. I remember this case, and I don't remember the name of the hospital, but it was a hospital that was not in very good financial shape, but it was a nonprofit, and as it was getting worse and worse and worse, the board decided to sell to another nonprofit, which was kind of into the mission. And then they got sued by a bank that had lent this hospital a significant amount of money. And the bank's position was, you had reached the point of being in the vicinity of bankruptcy, and therefore your fiduciary obligations should have shifted from duty of loyalty to the mission to duty of loyalty to the creditors. And I think the court sided with the bank on that. I don't know if you remember that case.
I think the language, the obligation may be there, but yeah. I think the language was probably different.
Yeah,
The court probably said, you know, without taking into account your debts, sold. They probably ended up unwinding and saying, "Wait a minute, that asset really belongs to the bank." Would be the outcome come there, but that doesn't mean that they have an obligation under the they have a contractual obligation, and that's part of the mission is to make sure your organization meets its contractual obligations. If you want to look at it that way. I think you can make
but
the argument.
Isn't there a point where, whether it's a for-profit or a non-profit, where your duty as a board member has to shift to the accreditors?
That's if you're in bankruptcy.
If you're in bankruptcy, that's going to happen by definition.
But how about if you're in the vicinity of bankruptcy?
I think the mission is the duty of loyalty is to the. I think it's not just the, if you look at care and all of them together, it's for the whole organization. It's not just, mission is important and everything you do needs to support mission. But if you made a decision that we're going to risk our assets against this liability, then you've done that within your mission, frankly.
Yeah, but I think you also, and I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but I mean, you also have to look at like what you're talking about, like in terms of thinking about fraudulent conveyances, thinking about marshaling the assets and making sure that you think about that if there is a bank involved and what you,
yeah.
how you have to protect the assets. And I think that's maybe what you're thinking.
I agree with that.
You know,
I do agree.
You're
obviously there's a legal requirement there, but I don't think the each of the, it's a question of mission versus that. It's
no.
you get the law says you do that first.
If it's a dues organization, if people paid dues to belong to this association and the association was going to morph into something that's close but not the same, did those people who've paid dues get their money back in that kind of a situation? Or can the money be transferred? You have to, it's a, you know.
That's an interesting question.
Charitable. 180,
yeah.
You know, 180,
yeah.
106.
Well, you probably, I mean, C3, you have to think about if they paid to be a member of an organization to get certain benefits,
right?
And you change the mission.
Yeah, it depends.
Of what
it depends on what they.
Right.
If it's dues and they get something in return,
right.
I agree, they owe that.
Yeah. Right.
But if it's what Channel 2 does, which is would you set up your MasterCard to pay $10 a month? Most people think of that as dues. It's not dues.
That's not, that's charitable contribution.
Yeah, it's not dues in that context.
Has anyone been in a situation like this? How about that? What actually happened?
What we did is we hired a consulting firm to see if there's any way we could shrink or sharpen our operation to make it operate as a it's a small hospital, standalone hospital, and the answer was no. It was we were being choked by a pension liability that probably should have gone away years ago but didn't. The next step was to see if we could merge and maintain our mission with another not-for-profit. And we spent 6 months on that search. And the answer was nobody in the Northeast would step up and do that. We actually only required long-term help on the pension. For operations only, we were covering our bills, but we just couldn't make the pension liability issues go away. And fortunately, we did because they just got worse with the new IRS ruling on mortality, longevity. But that's beside the point. So we looked, and we ended up with three organizations showing interest: one Massachusetts not-for-profit, one Tennessee for-profit, and one Massachusetts for-profit. We talked to all three. We would have been the only institution the Tennessee for-profit had outside Tennessee. So for lots of reasons, some you can imagine and some you can't, we decided that wasn't good. We talked to the not-for-profit in Massachusetts in depth, because that would have kind of been our choice. And it turns out they were just getting feelers to see how we operated, and They fessed up to that, actually, so
really getting credit for that.
So we were left with a for-profit in Massachusetts. And what we did with that, we protected our mission because we were still operating. We protected most of our employees. Many left, so we ended up not having to lay any off. We protected the pension rights, and we still have our patients. And we're doing okay, but the one thing that couldn't do is move the charitable assets. The donations had to stay in a not-for-profit, and I described it a little bit before. I had to follow the mission of the donor as much as you could, and that literally has taken 3.5 years to clear.
Yeah,
and it was only $2.2 million. I mean, it was not huge.
I had a friend who was on the board of a nonprofit, and things just really fell apart. I mean, it was a lot of very prominent people in New York, and she stepped up to the plate for the last 6 years, most of her. It's about 5 or 6 years, closing down their office, physically moving the stuff out of the office, getting pro bono legal help because they didn't have resources, dealing with the IRS, dealing with the other board members, getting people to sign off, dealing with the Attorney General's office, dealing with the IRS, dealing with everybody you could possibly think of, and I think they are now close to being done. But she spent thousands and thousands of her personal hours because her name was on it, and she and another board member really had to step up to the plate. The founder just kind of went off and did other things, and it was...
As the expression goes, stuff happens, right, and fortunately there's people like your friend who will step
right,
up and
the,
do that.
They had, you know, she had a few different pro bono lawyers because, you know, some of these law firms want to do it, but when they saw how much time it was taking, they could only allocate so much.
The project I was on cost money. The for-profit that purchased the hospital stepped up to the plate and picked up the legal fees for getting this part of it done.
So you moved a not-for-profit to a for-profit.
Yeah.
The situation is an organization where someone had owned this part of the organization, an asset, put it into a not-for-profit, wants to buy it back. I'm on the board. Do we let them buy it back? It's a for-profit. We've gone to the Attorney General's office and waiting for a ruling, but will we have to sue them to have that happen?
No, not for that.
Okay.
This is suing the Attorney General is just an archaic, I think it's an archaic statute buried somewhere under 40 pounds of whatever.
If it's a 180, I think it's 180 in the state,
yeah.
And it's a...
I think as long as it's, the protection has to be, it has to, you have to get it, you know, a few appraisals,
okay,
on the asset, so to make sure that it ends up being an arm's length transaction.
Yeah.
Once that's done, I think you're probably okay.
You mentioned the pension liability of the not-for-profit hospital should have gone away, and it never did. Could you talk more about what you are referring to?
Well, they had a defined benefit pension plan, very rich, and the board was frankly kind of like this one and didn't focus particularly on issues, and the management was careful not to have them focus too much on issues.
Does everybody understand the difference between a defined benefit and a defined contribution plan?
Yeah.
So that, we're booking the accruing the present value of all these liabilities that were going to be paid out, and then interest rates went down, and the IRS was pushing for funding, and we just couldn't make funding payments. It had been okay before these new rules came in, but then we couldn't make the funding payments. You can accrue the liability all you want, but if you can't write the checks, you got a problem. So we had a problem. That was enough, and that's taken down a lot of businesses in the last 5 years.
In the case of a corporation, they can make fundamental changes to a DB plan if they're in bankruptcy, but what about a not-for-profit? What's the legal framework that allows them to do something like that?
We would have had to declare bankruptcy, and the board refused to declare bankruptcy. That was one option that we brought to the board. And I agree, there was really no reason, particularly since we had this offer where the buyer was willing to, as part of the transaction, acquire the liabilities as well as the assets. And so at the time of the transaction, and actually today, there were a lot of winners in this particular deal. You know, just I'm like your friend. I was the one who said that can't be too bad. I'll take care of it.
And you were 6 feet tall at the time.
Yeah, 6'6".
I think you got reimbursed for some copying expenses.
So it wasn't.
I want to exercise my role as a timekeeper. It's 10 minutes after six. I'd like to thank Barry very much. And if anybody wants to continue to stay with this conversation, please feel free to do that. And if anybody needs to leave, we certainly understand. So thank you very much.
Thank you all. It's been a fun conversation. It's the status of not-for-profits and volunteer boards is always been intriguing me for about 20 years. And you can take the same, I've seen it happen, you take the same person who's on a for-profit board getting $50,000 a year in fees or whatever it is, and get them on a not-for-profit board, and you'd think they'd stop their education somewhere prior to kindergarten.
As a relative newbie to this kind of set of issues, just hearing about all this, it's sort of like, why would you ever want to join one of you? I suppose you care about the cause.
I think you have to care about the cause. Yeah. And care about community. I think, you know, there's some, it may be self-saying. We're turned off? No, we're not turned off.